This story was produced with original reporting from Cinnamon Janzer for Civil Eats.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Reed Johnson, and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Jill Freitas, Farah Siddiqui, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and now is a great time to join because we can't do this without you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go online to bit.ly/KBOO or just text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest. Have a good night.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertoff, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. First, scientists despair over global warming. A survey of climate scientists by The Guardian found that our worst fears are coming true. About 80% of those surveyed expect global temperatures to rise to at least 2.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels this century, causing catastrophic changes. Half the scientists believe the rise will be even greater, 3 degrees centigrade. A common reaction by the scientific community is this one, quote, "I think we are headed for major societal disruption within the next 5 years. Authorities will be overwhelmed by extreme event after extreme event. Food production will be disrupted. I could not feel greater despair over the future." That from a climate scientist at the University of Tasmania. All authors and editors connected with the annual reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, were contacted for their opinion. Roughly half responded. Nearly all believe everything possible must still be done to counteract climate change. But the threat to human life is palpable. As The Guardian reports, quote, "The experts said massive preparations to protect people from the worst of the coming climate disasters were now critical. One at the State University of Rio de Janeiro said, quote, I am extremely worried about the costs in human lives. A South African scientist said, I expect a semi-dystopian future with substantial pain and suffering for the people of the global south. The world's response to date is reprehensible. We live in an age of fools." Next, glitches in U.S.-China people-to-people exchanges. In recent talks between U.S. and Chinese leaders, one common ground has been support for more people-to-people exchanges, particularly in education. Presidents Biden and Xi both mentioned the importance of these exchanges at their last summit meeting, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, during his April trip to China, gave a talk to American students there on how critical study in China is for cross-cultural understanding and prevention of misperceptions between governments. But the reality is quite different. U.S. students in China total fewer fewer than 1,000, and only about 400 went to China for study a year ago. Now, the Defense Department has suddenly announced termination of all but one West Coast flagship program in Chinese, citing cuts by Congress in funding. University of Oregon and University of Washington are among the affected schools. The decision caught language teachers by surprise. They had every reason to think Chinese language programs would be strongly supported in the national interest. Flagship programs offer substantial financial support for rigorous training in neglected languages that are considered of national security import, including Arabic and Persian, as well as Chinese. Now, of 30 universities that hosted flagship programs, only 19 remain. There has been a significant fall-off in student enrollment in Chinese, however, just when fluency is most needed in or out of government service. Meantime, nearly 300,000 Chinese students are studying in the United States right now. But official Chinese complaints about the treatment of their students are increasing. A foreign ministry official said last month, quote, "The U.S. side keeps overstretching the concept of national security and has arbitrarily canceled Chinese students' visas, forbidden their entry, and forcibly repatriated them without any conclusive evidence, causing enormous harm to relevant students. The inspection rooms at some U.S. airports have become a nightmare for Chinese students," unquote. What the U.S. side is doing, he said, contradicts its statement about facilitating and supporting people-to-people exchanges. Both countries are suddenly emphasizing the safety of travelers in each other's country. The U.S. State Department has put out a travel advisory for students and others. China responded with a travel warning of its own and a personal warning from its ambassador to the U.S. An article in Latitudes, the newsletter of the Chronicle of Higher Education, says, quote, "Ambassador Xiefeng held a safety journey in the U.S. event, cautioning about risks to Chinese students and other travelers, including harassment and potential deportation when entering the country, anti-Asian discrimination, and government interference with people-to-people exchanges." Ambassador Xie also accused American leaders of, quote, "poisoning the public opinion environment and harming the relationship between the two countries." The Chinese embassy later posted a pamphlet online with safety tips for navigating the United States. Needless to say, these tit-for-tat warnings reflect the politics of U.S.-China relations today. The China threat being pushed in Congress, and American public opinion now very unfavorable toward China, and Chinese upset with the U.S. so-called Cold War mentality and containment of China. Sadly, students and researchers in both countries suffer from this negative dialogue. Xi Jinping's trip to Europe. Xi made his first visit to Europe in 5 years, mainly to promote business and soothe European irritation over China's green exports, such as EVs, that are flooding the European market. Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, said, quote, "These subsidized products, such as electric vehicles or, for example, steel, are flooding the European market. At the same time, China continues to massively support its manufacturing sector, and this is combined with domestic demand that is not increasing. The world," she declared, "cannot absorb China's surplus production." She also got an earful on China's support of Russia in the Ukraine war. Von der Leyen urged Xi to, quote, "use all of China's influence on Russia to end its war of aggression against Ukraine." In much stronger language than EU government officials use, she spoke of Russian nuclear threats in its, quote, "war of aggression." She said Xi had played, quote, "an important role in de-escalating Russia's irresponsible nuclear threats," unquote. Nuclear weapons were brought up because of an announcement from the Russian Defense Ministry that it is planning to hold drills on tactical nuclear weapons. A Kremlin spokesman said the drills were in response to French, British, and American statements on the war in Ukraine. French President Emmanuel Macron has been vocal in refusing to rule out sending ground forces to Ukraine. British Foreign Minister David Cameron said last week that Ukraine was now entitled to use British weapons to strike Russian territory. Von der Leyen also took aim at Chinese support of the Russian military-industrial complex, saying, quote, "More effort is needed to curtail delivery of dual-use goods to Russia that find their way to the battlefield. And given the existential nature of the threats stemming from this war for both Ukraine and Europe, this does affect EU-China relations," unquote. Perhaps they will, but up until now, China's support of Russia, repeated in strong terms when Putin visited Beijing last week, is not being reduced, and neither is European business with China. In other news, Israel's isolation. Israel's international isolation continues. Turkey announced that it had halted all trade with Israel until, quote, uninterrupted and adequate humanitarian aid is allowed into Gaza, unquote. Total imports and exports in Turkey's trade with Israel come to about $7 billion annually. Turkey has also joined the South African case on Israel's genocide that is before the International Court of Justice. In Holland, hundreds of intellectuals signed an open letter to the World Court accusing Israel of genocide. In a case brought by Nicaragua before the International Court, the court ruled that Germany is not violating the Genocide Convention by providing Israel with military and financial aid. Nicaragua had hoped a ruling would stop Germany from providing arms and further rule that how the arms are used would be subject to investigation. Germany argued that it was in fact working to achieve a ceasefire in Israel and was providing humanitarian relief to Gaza. The court has yet to rule on the South African appeal that Israel is committing genocide, though it has issued an interim ruling that the charge is, quote, plausible. In the United Nations, the General Assembly adopted a resolution May 10 that Palestinians qualify for full member status. The vote was 143-9 with 25 abstentions. The U.S. voted no. This vote came after the U.N. Security Council vetoed a similar resolution in April, with the U.S. again voting against. The Palestinian delegation now has many, but not all, the privileges of any other nation state in terms of participation in U.N. activities. Full participation will still require approval by the Security Council, which means another U.S. veto. Israel's decision to kick the Al Jazeera news agency out of the country isolates Israel in another way. It removes one of the few foreign news agencies operating in Gaza. Israel's decision also removes a news bureau that, as one observer writes, quote, gave Israelis a better shot at getting their message to the Arab world than shutting it down. Over the years, many Israeli officials have been interviewed on Al Jazeera, and the Israeli army's Arabic spokesman has appeared on the network during the current war. And while Al Jazeera has been partial to Hamas, its reporting, widely read throughout the Middle East, will now demonstrate that a democratic Israel can't abide having a critical news bureau in its midst. And a footnote, let it also be said that one major Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, does report the unvarnished truth about the war's critics, Netanyahu's failed leadership, and the human costs, Palestinian as well as Jewish. This reporting has earned Haaretz the tag "The Hamas Daily" from Itamar Ben-Gvir, one of Netanyahu's ultra-right cabinet ministers. President Biden holds back the bombs, but nothing else. In an escalation of U.S.-Israel tensions over Israel's invasion of Rafah, President Biden ordered a pause in U.S. shipment of some 3,500 bombs. But this move was quickly overshadowed by his pending release of some $1 billion in weapons to Israel, $700 million in tank ammunition, $500 million in tactical vehicles, and $60 million in mortar rounds. In an apparent effort to justify continued arms deliveries to Israel, a State Department official offered Congress on May 10 a tortured rationale. On one hand, the administration says it is, quote, reasonable to assess that Israel has violated international law in Gaza. Israel has also, quote, has not shared complete information to verify whether in specific instances it has used U.S. weapons in violation of humanitarian law. But Israel has, quote, the knowledge, experience, and tools to implement best practices for mitigating civilian harm in its military operations, unquote. However, quote, the results on the ground, including high levels of civilian casualties, raise substantial questions about whether those best practices are being used. So what is the conclusion by the State Department? Israel's assurances about its use of U.S. weapons consistent with international law are, quote, credible and reliable. U.S. aid will therefore continue. So much for National Security Memorandum 20, which critics of the aid had hoped would provide justification for Biden to stop arms deliveries altogether. Prime Minister Netanyahu is defiant in the face of Biden's decision about withholding bombs. If we have to stand alone, we will stand alone, he said in a video message. But he is being reassured once again that the U.S. has Israel's back. As 400,000 Palestinians flee the Rafah area, the Israeli Defense Forces are moving deeper in defiance of U.S. warnings, but with no consequences in terms of U.S. military aid. Finally, homophobia in South Korea. The prospect of a liberal administration retaking power in South Korea has the ultra-conservative Christian Church pushing in advance for restricting LGBTQ individuals and groups. This radical group's battle cry is preventing a, quote, homosexual dictatorship. As the New York Times reports, quote, alongside Japan and Turkey, South Korea ranked among the least LGBTQ-inclusive countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that is, all the major economies. Now these prejudices are manifesting in a coordinated attack on young people's rights. In a campaign orchestrated by South Korea's powerful radical Christian lobby, says the report, anti-gay protesters have been working relentlessly to cancel a set of regional bylaws that protect school children and teenagers from discrimination on several grounds, including sexual orientation and gender identity, unquote. Some of those bylaws have already been abolished. The conservative campaign must be seen for what it is, says the Times, part of a concerted effort to erase LGBTQ visibility from schools and ultimately from South Korean society, unquote. Every attempt in the Korean National Assembly to pass a broad anti-discrimination bill has failed, despite substantial public support. A nationwide survey by the National Human Rights Commission in 2022 found 67% were in favor of the measure. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Birdie. It's been over 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. At various stages of the Russia-Ukraine war, some have wondered whether there was any possibility of negotiations that would lead to a political settlement. Pat Willerton is a professor of political science at the University of Arizona. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
This war has been going on for quite a while. Occasionally, we hear about negotiations between the two sides. And what's going on there? Is there a possibility of negotiations leading to a solution from what you've seen recently?
No. The Russians are basically winning. Essentially, they're accomplishing their goals. They're not going to negotiate other than surrender. It looks to me with the retirement or the pushing out of Victoria Nuland, who was the top government official who was responsible for the Ukraine area since 2014, that the United States has essentially determined the Project Ukraine is going down and we're now going to carefully walk away. So Russia is going to achieve its goals. I don't know how long this will go on. They have not operated the way I might have predicted. I'm not a specialist in military matters. I thought this would have been over a long time ago. It was never a stalemate. The Russians have always been completely in control of the situation. They chose to pursue this with one arm tied behind their back. The other hand had a glove on it. We see in Gaza more people have been killed in 4 or 5 months than have died in this war in over 2 years. So they proceeded carefully. They tried to avoid killing a lot of people. Both sides, I think, preferred not to kill civilians. But basically, Kiev regime has run out. They're running out of men. They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of equipment. They're simply slowly collapsing. And the Russians are now essentially a steamroller. They're very slowly grinding their way westward. And I don't think anybody knows how far they're going to go or how this will end, but I would say they are going to achieve their goals. Ukraine is not going to be in NATO. It will be demilitarized. They're basically destroying all of the military capability. You know, right now we're debating whether to send them $61 billion. I think in the end we will, because it's in the interest of most members of Congress, because of the $61 billion, about 40 will stay here and we'll go to Lockheed, Raytheon. We have Raytheon here in Tucson. We love Raytheon. We want that money. Raytheon is just, they're just making profits head over heels. My wife works with some people there. They're hiring. They're doing great. Raytheon is doing great. It's great for the economy. And that's what's happening in many parts of the United States. So we're going to ultimately approve the money, even though the Speaker of the House is holding it up. But he'll cave, I think, in the end, because his members want that money. But it won't make any difference. What people don't understand is, I'll just give you an example. As I follow this and the reports I look at, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, the Russians have destroyed $20 billion worth of equipment we've given. They've taken out about 4 Patriot missile systems. They've taken out 3 or 4 HIMARS. They've already destroyed 5 Abrams tanks. We gave them 31, and at least 5 have been destroyed. They're just taking out all of this equipment. There's nothing we can do to stop them unless we want to send troops and go to war with Russia. That's the only thing left. And I think we've decided we're not going to. We're not going to go to war with Russia. So we're going to back off. I think the United States is slowly withdrawing. And so to finish up, the departure of Nuland is a profound symbol because the person in charge is gone. She's now a professor at Columbia University and will be opining in the New York Times and speaking. And she's being
reported. But was she forced out or did she go voluntarily?
Well, we don't know. I mean, is this somebody that's getting off the ship as it's going down or whether they were pushed out? I really don't know. There are people I respect who are more connected to the government who take both perspectives. She was pushed out or she saw the signs that were of what was coming and she chose to get out because this is going down. And she doesn't want to be in the State Department when we see Russian forces, let's say in Kiev, and Zelensky has fled the country. So I really don't know, but she's been replaced by someone who was our ambassador in Afghanistan when it collapsed. And the people that are coming into the State Department with power, the people that are in charge, are looking at China. Their focus is on Asia, on the China threat. They are not focused on Russia. I think what I'm trying to suggest is, this is my reading. I'm not in the government. I'm just watching. My reading is, we're done. Operation Ukraine has failed. The one in Georgia failed in 2008. You don't hear anything about that anymore. We tried to bring them in NATO. This one is going down. And as you may have also noticed, President Macron of France has talked about sending troops to Western Ukraine, trying to rally other European countries to do this. This would be really a very serious development. Most European countries are declining sending troops into Ukraine. President Putin has just commented on this in a very high visibility interview in Russia. As he said of Polish troops, if any Polish troops that go into Ukraine will never leave Ukraine. That's how he worded it.
What about the armed groups that we hear about from Ukraine going into Russia and staging attacks? Is that a big deal at all?
Well, it's symbolic. And of course, it gives maybe those who support the Zelensky government hope. But, you know, what happens? They cross the border and they seize a settlement. They fire on a market in Belgorod and kill 12 people. They take out a tanker ship in the Black Sea. None of this changes where this is going. These are PR stunts, the way I see it. And let me just say, in terms of what's going to happen, there is a very bad consequence, I think, for Ukraine. And the consequence is now Odessa will now be brought into Russia. They're never going to allow this to go on again. They're going to bring that in. They're going to bring Kharkov in. These are all going to be absorbed into Russia. Russia has now Crimea. They've had it for 10 years. They added 4 of the 25 provinces that were once of Ukraine, you know, in the east, the Donbass. And now we're going to see 4 more, Kharkov, Odessa, and 2 more. The Russians simply are not going to ever allow this again. So I think—
Although at first they were willing to say, you know, you can have your sovereignty, you can have it,
right,
provided it's in a neutral way and not join NATO,
right,
and we'll leave you alone. But now you're saying that they want to go much further.
Well, I mean, it's changed now. They've been in a war. They've lost 50,000 troops. 100,000 have been wounded. We're in a different— they're winning. Why would they make concessions now? It makes no sense. They're winning. And a number of their politicians have been clear. We will negotiate. We're going to negotiate surrender. Surrender means no NATO. The Zelensky government, they call them Nazis, they're nationalists, they're fascists, whatever you want to call them. They have to go, and they're going to be demilitarized, and Ukraine will be left with a military comparable to that of Switzerland. In other words, enough to sort of maintain self-respect, but not to be a threat. These are the goals. The Russians are achieving all of them. And so I think there's nothing, I mean, you're right. Unfortunately, there was an agreement in March 2022 in Istanbul that was signed by the representatives of Ukraine and Russia, and
Boris Johnson
rushed in and stopped it. So that was then, and this is now, you know. And so I think, look, the Russians are very savvy about how to appear. They want to come off like they are, shall we say, reasonable. They don't want to anger the Indians, the Brazilians, the South Africans. There are all these countries that basically support them. People don't understand this. The world is with Russia. 85% of the world is with Russia. The only countries that are with Zelensky are European, and I can't even say North American, because the Mexican president has blamed us for the war. He doesn't stand with him. No country in Latin America is embargoing or putting, I should say, sanctions on Russia other than Bermuda. No one does. So the truth of the matter is, the world is not opposed to Russia. But my point is that the Russians have to appear to be conciliatory. They will sit down and negotiate. I don't think you'll ever say hear them say, we won't. Putin, apparently, earlier today said, we're ready to negotiate. They're ready to negotiate surrender.
Are there people in the East who are resentful of Russia because they think the Russians have caused too much destruction? And
the feeling there is the Russians are their liberators. My friend is waiting. He's from Kharkov. His family's in Kharkov. They're waiting to be liberated. If you look at the interviews of people in Avdiivka, this recent site of tremendous fighting, there were some that stayed. They're thrilled. They welcome the Russians. They discuss what went on when the Kiev people were there. CNN, I was shocked, because Western media never show this because they're inconvenient truths. I mean, I'm talking mainstream media. They actually did a report. They were interviewing people in a town that's soon to be taken by the Russians. These people were offered the opportunity to evacuate. They said, no, we don't want to go back to, we don't want to move to Ukraine. We're waiting for the Russians. I couldn't believe that CNN showed this, because as you know, the common wisdom is that people there hate Russia. No, the people in the East want the Russians to come in. And, you know, the four regions that joined Russia, of course, we don't recognize the referenda. I don't have any doubt that the people that voted what they wanted. Now, I think the people that didn't vote opposed it and didn't want to vote, but they had like 80% turnout. It was like 90-some% voted for. No, I think in those places, they identify as Russian and they feel they've been the victims of the regime in Kiev for the last 10 years. So no, I don't. That is not the view in the East. Now, I know somebody here, for instance, who apparently the family came out of Mariupol, which was the site of a horrific war, battle, and would tell you that, you know, her family, you know, they hated the Russians and what the Russians did. But on the other hand, when you look at when the city was evacuated and when people left there because it was just left in ruins, 90% of them went east. They went to Russia. I think it was overwhelmingly pro-Russian. You know, I live in a community in Tucson, 80-20 Biden, Trump. But there's Trump people here. They would tell you we're Trump country, but they're not. It's Biden country. So, you know, in other words, in any community, there's a mix. But when you go further east, it's more pro-Russian. When you go further west, it's more anti-Russian. You go to some of the Western Ukrainian regions, you know, back before all of this started, they voted 98% for the anti-Russian candidate. Absolutely anti-Russian. But this image we have that everybody there thinks that way is not true. It's not true. So it's very split. Again, the elections were always very close, always close. It's like the United States, 50-50. And you could look at a region like here. We all know how Rhode Island's going to vote this fall. We all know how Mississippi's going to vote. It's just a handful of states. I've been one of them, Arizona. We don't know. We could go either way. I think you're in California. We know how you're going to vote. So this is the way Ukraine was. People knew, but there were a few areas where people flipped. So this is the way the country was. It was very divided. To be honest with you, I don't know what you find in your community. Here, the interest has fallen. There's not much interest in Ukraine anymore. We're focused on the Israeli situation. And I think beyond the Middle East, there's more concern about China than there is about Russia. I think what's coming...
Well,
I think
that's what the conservatives in Congress want. They want to take attention away from Ukraine and focus on China, it looks like.
Well, the other thing is, what do you do? I mean, as I said, I ask you the question, and it's not a rhetorical question. I'm sincere. How are we going to stop the Russians? I see no way now. The sanctions failed. I don't understand what people thought when we tried that. Over 17,000 sanctions. Their economy is very strong. It's stronger than ours and any European country. I mean, what were they thinking? This is the most resource-rich country in the world. That was the key to all of this. They were going to be put in great economic pain, and then they'd get rid of Putin. Didn't happen. He's going to get reelected easily. He's very popular. This isn't about guns at people's heads. I know that that's what people here think. They know exactly what's going on. They're very happy with the state of the economy. They support what's going on in Ukraine. And so, you know,
there was a small peace movement in Russia. right?
Yeah.
And Ukraine.
Look at Navalny. I mean, Navalny was only, he was a heroic figure in our narrative for us. He's not important to Russians. Russians thought he was an eccentric, to be honest with you. He was not a threat to Putin. This is our narrative. This is our view. You have to understand, you know, there were 1,000 people showed up when he died in a metropolitan area of 18 million. So, you know, again, we live in a different reality here about Russia. And I noticed when Tucker Carlson did the interview, he, you know, he spent a few days there, went around and showed things. And they showed these things like, you know, all the progress economically. And then this was all criticized as propaganda. But that's the way it is. I mean, what do you want? The country is doing well economically. Germany is careening towards a depression. All of the rest of Europe is in a recession. We are growing, the United States, but at a lower rate. I mean, this is reality. You just look at the IMF numbers, the World Bank numbers. This isn't propaganda. I think the problem here is people don't want to hear this. So I think maybe what will happen here is what happened to Afghanistan. I noticed no one talks about Afghanistan. We were there 20 years. We were committed to the status of women in Afghanistan. What happened to that? We don't talk about it anymore. I assume Ukraine will go away. It's unpleasant. It's unpleasant what happened. That's how we'll look at it. And we
will the leadership talk about the Ukraine syndrome like they talked about the Vietnam syndrome as an excuse to
spend
more on the military?
I just don't know. I mean, my worry now is, of course, the dynamic situation in the Middle East, which could completely go out of control. And I'm also concerned about China. China is also a serious matter. We're a powerful country, but I think we got a little accustomed to the power we had about 20 years ago. We just don't have the power that we could take on all of these regions simultaneously. And maybe in the end, that's why President Biden, who's absolutely opposed to Putin, absolutely committed to Ukraine, is allowing this to go on. Maybe in the end, they see we've run out of options unless we want to go to war. I don't think we want to go to war with Russia. They will go to war. They will go to war over this. They're very clear about it. Like President Kennedy in 1962, who was willing to go to war, Putin will go to war over Ukraine. And that's the decision we have to make. I've never met anybody who said, yes, I'm willing to risk a nuclear war.
That's University of Arizona professor Pat Willerton speaking with KB.